Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Time to take a look at the world of computers and software with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. Thanks for listening in, by the way. Thanks to Peter for being here today. And if you'd like to join in with your own question, comment, maybe something's going on with your computer, your software you want to ask about, maybe there are some new things on the horizon you wonder about, whether or not you should buy a computer now or wait. You know, those are questions we often get. Well, if you have one, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And, of course, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Pete, welcome back.
Always great, Larry.
What's new in the horizons out there in the computer world?
Well, I'll tell you, as far as looking at new computer systems, you know, for people returning back to going to college or just getting ready for the new school year, what a choice of laptops. You know, I can't believe I'm seeing stuff in the, like, almost $300 range for a complete system, you know, operating system, screen, hard drive, wireless, at least 512 megs of memory. But the ones that they're finally configuring with one and two in the price range of $4.5 to just under $800.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. It's great to see. And, you know, they're appliances. So, you know, the more they keep pumping them out, you know,
cheaper it is,
and the more competition, you know, price point pressure, and you know, look at the digital camera industry, same thing. You know, looking at a 3-megapixel camera isn't even really an option anymore. It's you know, 5, 6, 7, you know, within $150. The memory cards, dramatic price drops in memory cards, thumb drives. So, you know, for people that have you know, precious data, and they're not doing their backups, you can buy like 3 packs of 1 gig thumb drives, you know, that slip into USB ports for like, I think it was like $20 or $30.
Yeah, that's so amazing.
And, you know, you carry those around in your pocket. I carry one with me all the time, make sure I have backups taken off site in case something happens to a couple of my main systems. So, you know, really no excuse to back up that, you know, the data that you, you know, really think is precious and priceless. It's just, it keeps getting better.
Well, I tell you what, lots of people want to visit with you, so let's go to the phones. And Peter in Stoughton, you're up. Hi, Pete.
Good morning.
Hi. Morning.
I have probably a very basic question about sending a message via email. I know the difference between BCC and CC, but I'm wondering what is the difference between the to line and the copy set line? I could have, you know, five different names on the to line and nothing on CC, or vice versa, and I'm wondering what the differentiation is.
Okay, the to line is, you know, who the message is directed to. So you could actually have multiple email addresses in the two.
That's what I usually do.
Yeah, typically they're separated by a semicolon and a space. Programs, you know, if you do that for a group, it'll automatically, you know, set it up that way. The CC, normally, it really goes back to, you know, the teaching of, I guess, business English. Mm-hmm. When you're writing a letter, you've got your main person you're writing to, and then, you know, at the bottom of the letter, I'm talking about a physical letter.
Physical letter,
you put CC, and then, you know, who is it being copied to? Because the primary audience of that letter, who it's addressed to, is who it should be going to, and then anyone else that should be alerted to or have information from that letter that's being included in the discussion, but doesn't really have to be, but it's not the primary target or the primary audience, but really needs to be aware. Those are who you CC or copy the letter to. Okay. Now, the BCC is different.
Yeah.
Because that you can't, unless you had disappearing ink, in a sense. BCC is a blind carbon copy. It's, yep. So it's a carbon copy of that email that's going to someone's email address, but the primary sender and the people that are on the CC or the carbon copy
don't know.
Do not know that.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea. So for example, if you want to email a message out and you want to send it to somebody and CC a number of people, but you don't want them to know that someone's going to be there for a surprise, you BCC the email to this other person, relative, friend, or whatever, and everyone else has no idea that this person's going to be there because they're yep. getting the same information.
That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Here's the other thing. You know, normal etiquette when you're sending out large emails, in other words, when you're sending out when I say large email, I'm not talking about the size of the email. I'm talking about how many people
right.
are receiving it. So you're sending an email out to many people. Some people get offended. So we call this net etiquette. Some people get offended that their email address is included to a whole list of other people. In other words, this whole group of people you're
right.
emailing. So what you might want to consider doing when you're emailing a large list is that you put the list into the BCC and you actually can send it to one person on the list and that looks like they're the only ones getting it. But really in the text of the email, you're telling the whole group. Or you can also email it to yourself. So now you're getting a copy of the email, but the rest of the, you know, and it's addressed to the list so they know who they are, whoever's getting it. The other thing that I like to do is when I'm sending out a list to a whole group, I have a number of email addresses. So I may include one or two of my other email addresses out, you know, in the CC or the BCC to make sure that I'm getting it so I can see if there's a problem with what I sent out or I can
sure.
see how it looks and see
I've
if
done that too.
Yeah, see if I mess something up. And here's the other thing. If you're sending out to an extremely large list, I mean thousands or tens of thousands, the software that people typically get for their desktop, like Outlook Express and I think Entourage. Outlook and Pegasus and so forth, those programs are really not designed for large group emails. And when I mean large group emails,
thousands.
I'd say more, let's say more than 500 to 1,000.
Okay.
So 10,000, 20,000, 60,000. There are special programs out there that handle that. And what they're able to do is sync up with all the different engines out there when they're sending emails, because you're talking about waves of, you know,
right.
these emails going out. And it doesn't, it's efficient that it doesn't copy the entire email message. It's kind of like grabbing it and sending it out versus, you know, the same thing over and over and over again. And there are different settings so that you can handle very large lists. Otherwise, you're going to sit there and wait while your computer is sending out all these emails.
Fritz in Fish Creek, your turn. Hi, Fritz.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm wondering why the computer won't go into hibernation, when it should.
It won't go to sleep, in other words.
Yeah.
Okay. Could be a number of reasons. One is you may have perhaps a scheduled task that you may not even realize is actually scheduled to occur. So that could be one thing that wakes it up. Another one is you could be having something. You could have something running in the background that is actually going on all the time without you even realizing it. And that will prevent the computer going into hibernation because it's actively doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's system's different. I'll give you another example. you could have an online service running, like Instant Messenger, that could get in the way, or Microsoft's Messenger service. You could have your web browser open, and it could be serving pop-ups or being, you know, dynamically interacting with your computer system. So what you need to do is, if you look in the lower right-hand corner of your screen, if you're running Windows, you'll have all these little pictures or little icons in what we call the system tray. And you have to understand what those are. And once you understand what they are, you can decide whether or not you want them. So you can turn them off. You can prevent them from coming up again. And what I've done is on my tips page at Infostar.com, there's a, I forgot the number of it, but there's an actual tip where it talks about Windows startup. And it has a number of resources I've linked to there to help you optimize what you need to have start up in your Windows system and what you don't, because some of these applications will sit there and interact with a website, and when you're thinking you're putting your computer to sleep, you know, you want it to go into hibernate mode because it's not doing anything, you want to conserve power, those applications may prevent it. Now, the other thing is there can also be a glitch with the operating system and communication with the hardware and the firmware in your system. And the only way to check that out is to get as much detail about your computer and then go to the manufacturer's website and see if they've posted some kind of fixes or, you know, if you can email them and see maybe if you can get a response that says you're having a problem putting in Hibernate. And they may tell you to do the same thing that I just mentioned. And the way to get a lot of information about your computer, there's an application that fortunately has been free for many, many years. It's called Belarc Advisor, B-E-L-A-R-C, and then Advisor, so you can Google it. I link to it off of the Virus Info Center page, but it's an application you need to download. It's I think it's under 1 meg. For those that have dial-in connections, you know, take a little bit longer, but it's very useful in that once you download it and you run the application, it will tell you everything that you need to know about your computer in terms of the operating system, what kind of updates you've done to it, all different versions of you know, what you have in terms of hardware and so forth. And it's not 100% accurate on the hardware, but it's pretty darn close, and it provides a lot of useful information. Mm-hmm. So what I would go ahead.
I can manually put it into hibernation, but okay. It, you know, that in the power option mm-hmm. thing, it won't do that automatically.
Yeah, like I said, you know, there may be a manufacturer's problem with when you try to put you're forcing it to go into the hibernate. Versus something where you're expecting it to after, let's say, 20 minutes or 30 minutes. There may be something inadvertently running behind that's preventing it. You know, when you're forcing something to do something, you know, you're calling its hand and saying, okay, I want you done. I want you to basically go to sleep now. Versus something that you may not realize is actually running. And when you put it in that auto mode and say, okay, in 20 or 30 minutes, you know, go to sleep, and this thing is still running in the background. The other thing, like I said, is there could be a glitch with the manufacturer's firmware and interacting with the operating system.
So those are the options. Good luck.
I'll give you a perfect example of something running in the background that I set up at my wife's clinic.
Oh.
And I'm sitting there, and I've got a network of computers and the hard drive on the server, and I work on the server at the same time for doing accounting and also clinical records and things like that. And I'm hearing the hard drive just like constantly going, and I hadn't done anything. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what's going on? And some of the files are fairly large. Well, I have a backup server that monitors this system, and it wasn't that long after people had, you know, quit from work, and it was given the drive a once over, you know, looking for what needed to be backed up. So it's just constantly running. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, no one's here. I'm not doing anything. I haven't touched anything. And it's running. Constantly running. And I logged on. I did a control alt delete. I used the task manager and I was looking at the files, you know, what's occupying CPU time, and lo and behold, it was the backup server saying hi to the hard drive.
Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Green of Madison, of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant with us today. Thanks for listening in. You could go to his website, by the way, at InfoStar.com. InfoStar.com, if you want to take a look at that. Lots of information on there. A lot of it as a result of this radio program. So really happy to have him with us again. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Jim in Eau Claire. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've enjoyed these programs each time I catch them. I usually catch them when I'm driving. About a year ago, we purchased a little Toshiba laptop for my wife to use, and an inexpensive one, so the memory isn't too great on it. Since installing Norton antivirus, it has really slowed down its operation a great deal. And I'm suspecting that there are a lot of programs running. You were just talking about that with the last person that called in. I'm suspecting there's a lot of people, a lot of programs running. And in the past, I've typed in msconfig and gotten a listing of all the programs that are started up. My problem is that as I never know whether I can eliminate them or not. I'm wondering if there's anything on your website or is there anything you can find that will give you information about those programs so you can know whether you can safely check them and clean out the memory.
Sure.
Okay. Do you know how much memory you have in the laptop?
No, I really don't. I'm thinking it's maybe 256, so that's one of the things I'm looking at doing is bumping that up.
Okay. I can tell you that going from 256 or 512 and adding probably a 1 gig memory strip will dramatically improve the performance of your system.
Okay.
The kind of the magical number for the Windows operating system is at least 1 gig of RAM.
Okay.
And that's just for doing, like, you know, browsing the internet, using word processing or Excel spreadsheet. Doing some bookkeeping and emailing and that kind of stuff. As far as Norton, Norton's a pretty heavy program. And when I mean heavy, it really it interacts with the web and the internet and the web to get updates. And it really likes to take hold of your system to make sure that it's protected. So it uses a lot of system resources to do that. And run in the background, constantly monitoring things. And when you say Norton, you may have a whole suite of their products, or you may only have their antivirus product.
But this is just the antivirus.
So it's when I say heavy, I mean it really interjects its presence on your computer. When it comes up for renewal, there are other options you may want to take a look at. One other consideration is that Norton and McAfee are typically the largest antivirus programs out there. So they're also targets for, you know, the people that are writing these worms, Trojans, and things like that. So when you're not, you know, the one with the big target on your chest, your chances are a lot less likely that you're going to get hit with something because, you know, you're carrying this target on your system.
Sure.
So what I've used a number of programs out there, Bitdefender's one, AVG, Avast, ClamWin is an internet project where a lot of people contribute to it. And based on experience, they all work quite well. Sometimes I even run two of them on my system at the same time, just depends the vulnerability of the computer that I'm working on, whether or not it really needs to, like my son's system probably needs to.
Five of them.
Five of them, yeah. As far as, you know, the recommendations, and we've talked about this many times in terms of you hit start, you hit run, you type in msconfig, you go to the startup tab, you see a whole bunch of programs with the checks in the checkbox, and you're like, okay, Pete's mentioned this on the show. What do I do? Well, you can learn from the School of Hard Knocks, and that is trial and error. And what you do is you click on start, click on run, type in msconfig, hit the enter key, click on the startup tab, and then go to that, and then painstakingly write that down. Or you can try and take a picture of it on your screen, which means you'd run something like Microsoft Paint. You would hit your print screen key on your keyboard, and then you would do a control V after you launch Paint. You may have to adjust the margins and so forth to get everything to print out on one page. Or you just sit there with a pen, paper, and pad and write down all the information that's on your screen in those lines with the checkboxes and what's checked off, and then uncheck all of them. And then save it, and then it'll say, do you want to restart your computer? And you restart your computer, and then you work with it and see how your computer works without all those things that are launched or loaded when your system starts up. And then if you notice something not working quite right, or not working the way you want it, or you wanted it available in that little system tray, then you have to try and identify what the checkbox is for it. Some of them are easy, and some of them are not.
Well, that's right. Some I can tell by the location,
right,
where they're stored, but there are always quite a number that I'm just uncertain,
correct,
about.
Now, here's the next thing to help you in your research. What you can do is on my tips page, so at infostar.com, and on the left-hand side, click on the tips page, and then look for the tip that talks about Windows startup. There are five linked resources, and they're in brackets, number one, number two, all the way through five in brackets. And each one of those is a resource that tries to define what you may see in those lines with your checkboxes. So in other words, they're resources trying to identify for you what exactly those are.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll look at that. I think there's an opportunity for someone to create a service where you send them a copy of that and let them analyze it for you.
It's better to see it on the individual system and testing it, because you can make a recommendation for something that may look like one thing but may actually be something different.
Okay.
So, yeah. You could be working side by side on two machines and their startups are totally different. And the things that run in the background, and the speed and how they're affected, it's amazing. And you kind of wish there were more standards out there for doing things like that.
Yeah, I sure do.
And when you install software, it will, a lot of times it will ask you, do you want to put it as a desktop icon? Do you want to put it in Windows Startup? I always say no to the desktop icon unless I really want it there. And I absolutely say no to the startup.
Right.
And programs that show up in the startup are like Real Audio. There's a Microsoft Messenger. I have a link on my tips page to eliminate the Microsoft Messenger icon. That's where there are two people, and they look like one's standing right behind the other. That's the Microsoft Messenger.
Okay.
You want to eliminate that, because that's like a back door for web, I don't know what I want to phrase, but the people that are trying to throw pop-ups at you are using the Microsoft Messenger backdoor to get through to your system. So I've got a tip on the tips page that links to, I think, probably at least three resources to explain how to get rid of that, because that can be very annoying.
Sure. Well, I think I'll try the additional memory, and if that speeds it up enough so that I don't get called too often to help, then I'll maybe live with the other for a while. But thanks for the help. I appreciate it.
Yeah, yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Joanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joanne.
Hello.
Hi.
I have two, maybe three problems. But anyway, the first one is when I'm trying to clean up my computer and I go to system or a startup and then programs and then system tools.
Right.
Go to disk cleanup and it analyzes the computer. It comes up with a list.
Right.
There's one called compressed files, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of stuff in there. And so I check that box, make sure that's one of the ones that's checked, and do the okay, do your thing button, and it cleans it up, and then I run through it again, and everything has been deleted except for the compressed files, and I can't seem to get rid of them. Is there a reason for that, or can I tackle it from a different angle?
Compressed files are not files that you want to delete. What it's actually doing is it's in a sense, archiving them.
Okay.
It's like squeezing out the digital water to make it a little bit more efficient so it doesn't take up as much space.
So I
wouldn't worry about it. What happens on the computer when you write a file,
mm-hmm.
whether or not it's really small or really large, it allocates a certain standard amount for that file on your drive. So a long time ago, there used to be this table that you had to adhere to, you know, in terms of a little text file would take up this huge amount of space. But what's happened is the larger the drives, the units become, I forgot what the exact size is, but it's more standard now.
Okay.
So that whether it's a small file or a big file, it's using this unit of measure, and what the compression is doing is trying to efficiently use the unit of measure for your drive
mm-hmm.
to store all your data so that it doesn't have to, you know, use as many seeks to get to it.
Okay.
So the compressed file is just a way of helping to free up some extra space. Now, a number of things I would recommend to try and free up space. If you've listened to the show before, you might have heard this. If you've listened to the show and you've heard it and you haven't done it yet, well, you really should do it because it will free up space. It could actually enhance a little bit of your speed issues because depending upon how full your drive is, it may be taking up a lot of valuable space. But what you can do is right mouse click in Windows on your recycle bin,
mm-hmm.
click on Properties, and change the size of the drive from the default of 10% to 1% of your drive.
Okay.
So, for example, if you do the math, a 20 gig hard drive, 10% is 2 gig. That by default it's taking up. So bring that down to like 200.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you click on, and you've been there before, click on your system tools, and then click on System Restore, and towards the lower left third, you'll see your System Restore settings. Click on that and change the bar from 12% of your drive to about 1%, and
okay.
that's for your System Restore. So if you're not using that, you should be using System Restore in Windows. And if you are using it, you should be changing the default settings that it comes with at 12% to down to probably about 1% of your drive.
Okay.
And that will free up, if we do the math, it's 2% of your drive. So that'll free up quite a bit of hard drive space on your system, and it
yep.
may help improve performance.
Okay.
Good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Joya in Fitchburg, you're next. Hi, Joya. Mike in Cushing. Hi to you, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm just glad to be on again.
Hi.
Peter, I called you or sent you an email last week about a problem I was having, and I don't know if you understood what I was doing. I'm on Internet Explorer,
okay.
and I get onto Outlook Express, and I'm trying to do some web searching while I've got Outlook on, and all of a sudden, it'll switch over to Outlook Express without me doing anything. And then I'll click back on my website, and it, bang, it goes right back to Internet Express, or Outlook Express. And I close out Outlook Express, shut it down, and I go to my website, pops Internet Outlook Express, comes right back on again, just like it was, right to my inbox, without me even, you know, clicking on it to open it up again.
It sounds like what's going on is the properties in your the file type that your that web pages are associated with. I'm just trying to speculate on what this might be. Might be associated with Outlook Express. So when it's going to a web page, for some reason Outlook is running this interference and thinking it should be seeing this web page. So it's trying to launch in response to you going to it. The only way to check for that is if you go to Windows Explorer and then go to, I'm trying to remember where it is, but it might be file, it's under file types, and then in the file types you need to look for the web page extension. So there's .htm, .html, and there might be a number of others to look for as well. PHP could be one. And if you look for those extensions, look to see if Outlook Express is the one that's being referenced in that list. Okay. Could be one area to look for. Have you done any kind of search online to see if other people are having that kind of problem?
No, I haven't. I was about to do that, but I haven't
okay.
done it.
You just might want to, you know, work on practicing how you're, you know, when you're searching, to try and do a number of different kinds of searches, where, you know, like Outlook Express mistakenly launches for web pages, problem Outlook Express launching with web pages.
Okay.
You know, just phrase it a number of different ways, using something like Google, or go to the groups in google.com and, you know, see if there are any news discussions out there. But it sounds like the file type might be the problem. For example, you know, if you're trying to launch Adobe Acrobat pages and they end with PDFs, or Microsoft Word documents and they end with .doc, if I told Windows that the .pdf should launch with Microsoft Word, it would try to launch Word, but it couldn't see the page because it was a PDF file. So it would show me an error on my screen. In your case, it's trying to launch Outlook Express, but since it can't see the web page, it's just launching Outlook Express.
Gotcha.
So it can't do any, it can't do anything else with it except just start up Outlook Express.
Gotcha. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Alan Westby, or South of Westby, had a question for you via email, Peter. And he says, with logos on the desktop, are resources being used? I think if they are displayed on the taskbar, computer resources are running. For the desktop, what's the method for removing the logos but not disabling their process?
Moving the logos. I think he's referring to the icons.
Icons, I'm sure, is what he's referring to, the icons on the desktop.
Well, you can you can actually delete the icons on the desktop. The key thing there is you want to make sure that you know what program it's associated with. So if you click on right mouse click on the desktop icon and then you click on properties, you can see the link to where that program is. So it'll tell you the drive and the folders and the actual program that it launches, the .exe file if it is, for example. Or some people have documents linked on their desktop. They save a file for their desktop because they want it to be able to click it right away. So that'll, by clicking, right mouse clicking on the icon, then clicking on properties and looking at where that file is, you're not if you delete the desktop icons, you're not deleting the program. You're just simply deleting the ability to quickly use a shortcut from your desktop to launch the program or get access to that file. Once you know where it is, you can then click on Start and Programs and look for that program that's on your desktop, and you might want to just compare before you delete it to see that, you know, that in fact is what's launching that program. But you're not going to affect anything. So yeah, you can clean up your desktop as much as you want. The key thing is just to know, you know, what program it's launching, know where it is. So if you ever have to find it again, you can right mouse click on your open desktop, add a new shortcut, then you'll browse your hard drive and you'll find that file that you deleted, and you can put it back on your desktop.
Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Are you familiar with the game Halo?
Yeah.
I want to set up a server, but do I got to set up just a separate computer? Can I just have it on my desktop, and then whenever I want to play it, I can hop on and whoever's playing with me is there?
Interesting. So you want to set up a Halo server?
Yep.
For just a small group of you,
can play it. I'm just sick of everybody cheating and stuff, and because I shoot somebody and they just keep coming at me and they just keep coming at me and kill me, and I just want to set up one where if they like start pulling this trap, I can just kick them off. And,
What kind of system do you have in terms of memory and stuff?
I've got a Pentium computer. It's 1.8 gigahertz. It's got 256 mega RAM. I know I need to upgrade the RAM because it's a little jittery when I put this on up to.
What kind of bandwidth?
I've got a cable modem, a Roadrunner.
Yeah, you're probably the resources you're going to run into problems with is the RAM, the memory. The hard drive space may be an issue too because the nature of Halo with the graphics and stuff.
It's awesome.
It is.
I love that game. I'm addicted to it. My wife hates it. She said she's gonna, when I'm away at work, she's gonna take the disc and throw it away. So I made a couple copies and hit them in the house. So that way, if she does do it, I got it. Yeah, because I spend 10 hours a day on there, when I'm not at work.
Yeah, well, that's not good. My son's been addicted to games like that, and he's. Actually, World of Warcraft was his recent fun, and he hasn't played that in a number of months, so he said, good for you. He's got to go off to school, and said he was going to take all these things with him, and I said, I don't think you're going to have room or time.
Work and stuff always gets in the way of games.
Yeah, but, in terms of setting up your own server, the safe thing would be, to get a separate system so that if something does happen to it, crashes or you have to redo it. There's not a lot of time invested in it other than just for that application.
What system specs do you recommend for something like that? Does it have to be a pretty quick computer or can it be,
Well, it depends on how many people you're going to have playing the game. I would say, the smaller the party, the less, you've got to have there for it.
Usually, the servers I see are usually about 15 people.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about something like that.
There's a number of game resources out there. I've got a whole bunch of them I've listed in my tips page. Okay. Or not my tips page, but if you go to do a search on infostar.com and probably type in GameSpot or something like that or hardware, there are some really good game sites out there for accelerating PCs and servers that you'll probably want to latch onto, as well as the discussion groups, because for having a server, you don't really need to put an emphasis unless you're playing on the server for graphics.
Okay.
And things like that can take away from the resources of the machine.
Okay.
It would be fun configuring a server. So you just have to put, enjoy the journey and put the time into the research for it.
Actually, my friend's an internet engineer, so I was going to get him to help me a little bit. But the other question, real quick question, is would it make a huge difference in putting, say, a gig of RAM in my computer? Would I see a major difference?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, going from 256 to 1.25, you'll see remarkable difference.
Yeah, because the sound is kind of choppy in the graphics. Sometimes I kind of lag and stuff. Like, I'll shoot somebody, and then they'll be, like, on the side of me right away.
Yeah, actually, I'm surprised you're playing with 256. Because I don't think my son's been at that level in quite a long time.
Good luck.
Quite a number of years.
Thanks for calling, Nick. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant with us today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking computers and software today with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison. Glad to have you listening in. We'll go right back to the phones and to Gene in Madison. Gene, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. No problem. Thanks for taking my call. I have two problems. The first one is I have a wireless network at home, and my girlfriend's laptop had to have its hard drive replaced, and we lost the configuration that had it working with the wireless network. Okay. Now when I go to connect to the wireless network, I can connect in that she can get to the Internet, but I can't locate my desktop, which is basically the print server, because that's where all the printers are attached. So I can't configure printer sharing, you know, remote printer sharing. And I get a message that tells me that the resource, which would be the work group, this is a Windows work group network,
okay,
says, you know, it says that, you know, the administrator, you know, you don't have the privileges to do that. So, you know, check with your administrator, except, of course, I'm the administrator.
Yeah, you're the administrator.
Right. I have another problem, too, but that's less worrisome than this one.
So do you have, is the work group the same for the laptop as it is for the rest of the?
Yes, it is. In fact, I have changed it on both computers and changed it back.
Mm-hmm.
So
you've tried to add the printer as a resource from your computer.
Right.
And
you know, it's go through the install printer process.
Right.
You know, and say, yeah, it's, you know, printer located on another computer.
Do you have all the patches applied to the laptop after it was redone?
Interesting question. I'm pretty sure that that's the case, because I like to keep myself pretty much up to date on fixes.
Okay, but I mean, did you reinstall the operating system, or, you know, to the hard drive and reconfigure
it? We had that done at a local shop.
Okay.
Okay, and everything else seems to work fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this. You know, without a printer, it's not very useful for her.
Right. I'm just trying to think of where the conflicts might be. I would just, you know, double check and make sure that all the updates have been applied to it. And you said you redid your work groups, and are you giving like blanket share permission to your printer resource, or, you know, did you have it like pointed, you know, to the old system?
It's a blanket. I didn't have any. You know, I just said enable printer sharing, and I don't care who it is.
Okay, the word I'm using, blanket, means like global, that, you know, everyone can have access to it.
Right.
Did you try installing the printer driver on the
I haven't done that yet, but that's my next thought, is to install the printer locally.
Right.
First.
Right,
and then try and locate it on the, you know, on the
right
on the
to
see network.
If you can change the port associated with it. Right.
Right.
Yeah, I would probably try something like that and see how that goes. The other thing is, if that doesn't work, I would probably try and search on the news groups. To see, you know, or is related to your problem, if there are any, you know, fixes out there. Sometimes there's, you know, an update or whatever that was inadvertently missed, or there's a conflict, and for whatever reason you have something turned on that should be turned off, And there might be this checklist out there, you know, for someone that had the similar problem.
Yeah, great.
All right, good luck.
What was the other?
The other question is that on my desktop, my girlfriend has an account, and whenever that account starts up after a reboot, Windows Media Player starts up. And I have gone into, like, MS Config and deleted it, or what I think it is, in MS Config, and it still pops right back up.
There might be a preference set up in the media player that's forcing that to start up.
Okay.
So I would check in the options and the settings for the player itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's the same thing with AIM, AOL. That kind of stuff drives me crazy because you set the preferences and it's not always where you think it is.
Thanks, Gene.
I was wondering in all this process why you have to go to 15 different places to configure networking.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. Dan and Alto, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi.
I'm having a problem just this past weekend logging on to the Internet. I have a high-speed DSL, and I can't log on to the Internet. The thing that's different this weekend is I think my daughter went and okayed updating McAfee.
Okay.
And now it tells you to restart the computer. It wants to restart the computer. I've done that. I've done everything I can, but somehow I think this McAfee is messing up my ability to get on the Internet.
Okay. The first thing I always tell people that having problems with internet connections, always check the service provider to make sure that
I did this morning. I called them and everything checked out.
Good.
To get a bunch of diagnostics.
Because you should always check with the internet service provider and make sure that they're not having a problem talking with you, and it doesn't take long for them to establish that they can see you and, you know, and so forth. Because what happens is if they're the problem, and you continue to try and troubleshoot it or resolve it and start making changes to things that are really working, then you got to get back to the way it was after they resolve their issues. Mm-hmm. So that's why I bring that up. There may be something in the McAfee program, the settings in there, that may be running a conflict. You know, if you want to, if you have access to the disks and you want to do an uninstall and then reinstall, you can do that.
That I don't have.
But what I would do is if you use like Internet Explorer, and then you go to I believe it's Tools and then Options, and then click on Connections. You may the Connections tab. You want to look in there and see what it says for gaining access to the Internet. And your default connection should be, you know, to always use the network because, you know, that's what you're on.
Okay.
There are some really good resources online that I link to both in the tips page and also my Tech Links page on home networking. And if you look those up, they will actually step you through the different settings to look for. The other thing is you said you called your provider.
Yes.
Did they offer to step you through to check, you know, your system for, you know, getting online with it, with them?
No, which kind of irritated me.
Usually they do that. Usually, you know, if you say you're not able to connect and you're paying for their service, they should offer you assistance to, you know, help you get back online with it.
I'd call them back.
Yeah. And the one other thing is, you know, if you don't get any satisfaction with that, whenever you make changes on a Windows system, it's a good idea to have the Windows Restore option on to make sure that it's on. And what I do is after I make a major update to the operating system or if I install a new program, is I make sure I create a restore point. And that way I can always go back Because sometimes I've heard, not sometimes, I've heard many, many times where someone's applied an upgrade to a software and you think you're getting, okay, the next best thing and this is going to be awesome. And then all of a sudden the computer doesn't work right anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what did they do to my system? So if you go back to the restore point, you can bring your system back to what it was prior to installing the upgrade.
And how do I do that?
If you click on Start, click on Programs, click on Accessories, click on System Tools, and then click on System Restore, it basically says, you know, create a restore point or create an access point or restore to, you know, a prior access point if you want to go back. And if it was an upgrade to McAfee, usually they create a restore point, you know, to go back to. Mm. So you might be able to go back to, you know, whenever your daughter, you know,
fooled around with it.
You'll just have to, you know, just confirm the date and time.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking computers and software today with Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in today. Pete, we always have a top 10 list, actually, of things you found on the internet. What have you got for us today?
Got a lot of really neat things. If you go to infostar.com, click on current or click on the archives and scroll down to today's date, they're all there. This first one is a resource for checking out K through 12 schools and also comparing them. It's called schooldigger.com. So if you're looking at moving or if you moved, you want to see what kind of options are available in your area, it's a great resource. This next one, I went through this. It's a 10-minute, and it's in a number of different languages, virtual space trip for 10 minutes. It's called spacewander.com, and it's very informative. And the amount of information that we know about our solar system now versus when I went to school, which is a long time ago, it's really cool and just kind of an eye-opener. This next one is called fightgridlocknow.gov, and it's our government's resource detailing the federal strategy to reduce congestion. And there's also a link to the DOT site, which is talking about the inspection of the bridges based on, you know, what happened last week. The next resource, kidsandguns.org. Resource about kids and guns and to help prevent gun violence and gun safety and so forth. Number five is called iLounge, iLounge.com. And guess what, Larry? It's an independent resource about iPods. iPhones and iTunes and probably anything that Apple's going to name with an I. The next one is automotiveforums.com, and it's a resource for auto enthusiasts, covers a wide range of topics and car shows and buying and selling and so forth. Number seven, a great resource for those people that have NVIDIA graphics products in their computers. It's for a fan of NVIDIA, and it's called nvnews.net. Mm-hmm. Number eight... It's a new, relatively new resource out there, and they call it a human-powered search engine powered by an enthusiastic and energetic group of guides. And if you go back probably, I'm going to guess maybe 8 years, about.com had its roots like that.
Yeah.
Mining Guides was another one. And there were a number of them, and this one claimed to be the first one, and I'm sorry to say that
it's not.
They're not the first one, and there are probably others out there. Number nine is liveplasma.com, and it's a search and discovery engine for music and movie fans. Didn't quite figure out how to use it, but it looks kind of interesting, so it might be worth checking it out. And this one... Larry, if you find you got some free time after you do all your radio shows, you might want to do a blog talk radio show. This is a resource that will allow anybody to create and host an individual live blog show online. So I just thought you need some more.
Yeah, I need more time on the air.
Fill up your time.
And all those are available. Just go to infostar.com and you'll find that whole list of how to get that information. All right. Let's go to Joya in Fitchburg. Joya, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two problems. I have a problem. I have XP window and with the DSL line. But every time I want to email somebody, it says only one taskbar is running. How do I fix that?
It says only one
taskbar is running.
Hmm. Are you able to send email?
Yes, I am able to send the email, but it says only one taskbar is running. If you want to shut off the computer, then sometimes it gives me the message. Sometimes when I open it, then it gives me the message. So I don't know what it signifies or how do I fix it.
Hmm.
The second question is...
Well, hold on a second.
I'm still not quite sure what's... If you're able to send email out, what are you using for email?
Well, I have the AT&T Yahoo as the server.
Okay.
And then I am using through Eudora.
Okay.
But Eudora, the latest 7 version.
Okay. So when you use Eudora to send and receive emails, you don't have any problems with that?
No, so far I haven't had any problems.
Okay. So you're saying there's another task that's running?
No, it said, I think there are supposed to be 2 taskbars. What I understood, I went to the tools and properties, and then when they're supposed then, but the message pops out saying that only one taskbar is running.
Yeah, that it sounds normal to me.
Yeah, I don't think you've got a problem there, Joya.
Yeah, it's just a message that happens to be popping up. There may be a little box that says if you don't want to see this message again, just click on the box and tell it to go away.
Oh no, it doesn't do that. I mean, I have to click on the X there to get out. It doesn't say if you don't. It's not like McAfee or the.
Well, if you want to go to my website infostar.com and email me a description of this with all the details on your system, then might have a better chance at trying to get an answer there
at trying to figure that one out.
What was the other thing that you were?
The question quick is how I'm using the digital camera. I'm transforming the pictures on the computer.
Yep.
To email those to in a series to somebody instead of each picture, how do I do that?
So you want to email or you want to create a CD?
No, I wanted to email them.
Okay. If you want to email pictures to someone, there's a number of considerations, okay? Number one is you need to, when you copy them to your computer,
right.
You need to know where those pictures are in your system so that you can attach them to your emails.
Okay.
Yahoo may or may not have a size problem. In other words, the size of the files that you're sending.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're sending a lot of pictures, those files can be fairly large depending upon the size of the megapixels that you're using.
Megabytes.
So there are a number of programs out there, WinZip, PKWare, ZipIt. There are other programs out there that will allow you to take a number of pictures and archive them or zip them down so that they're smaller and in one file.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would save that, and you have to know where you save it on your system, and then you can email attach it and send it out that way. The other option is to use, I'm trying to remember some of the resources out there. I know I linked to them in the last month or so, and even before that, like, was it Snapfish and... Mm-hmm. The Kodak has got a website for sharing pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So what you can do is you can look for some of these resources for sharing photos. And what they'll allow you to do is you create, you become a member, and it's free. and then you can upload the photos for free. And then you just tell people to go there and, you know, you they can look at it.
Yeah.
And then also some of the backup resources I've got linked to called xDrive. And there are I think I even have them listed here. Let's see. Trying to remember these backups. There it is. Okay, iBackups, Mosey, MyDocs, xDrive. Those are probably resources that you can use as well, where you can upload photos and share them too.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Joya, for calling. Daryl in Bloomington, your turn. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hi, Larry.
Hi.
Peter. My brother's got a problem. He can't get on the Internet. It was asking for a username and password. It said the password wasn't right or whatever. But I've been working on this stuff since 1995, and it frustrated me. I really think he's got a virus because he connects to TDS, the ISP.
Okay.
And they said they had a virus that was causing trouble, and he's got Norton, and he didn't keep it updated, and it's
yep.
old Norton, and I ran it, and it picked up and we deleted them, but that wasn't. It's probably one that it didn't pick up at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right.
So what I'm asking is, I've got a pretty recent deal, and the only thing I can do is burn CDs, but I know you've got a bunch of virus software. Is there any that I could download and then burn to the CD and let him run it and pick up that virus?
Yeah, the number of those that I link to, you can burn to a CD. In fact, a number of them are even out there on the Internet where, you know, someone else is saying, hey, I've got a bunch of utilities, and they actually bundle some of these free antiviruses, you know, along with their utilities.
Well, can you give me a name? I know where your source is there, but I couldn't really pick out one. Panda didn't seem to.
No, Panda is one that they either offer an online scan or they want you to buy their thing.
Yeah, that won't work. Yeah.
What you do is, you know, you need to, some of them you need to sign up with, and then they'll send you a link in the email validates, you know, that you're actually requesting this, and then they'll give you the download.
Yeah.
But you
think it will work when I burn it to the CD for him, right?
I've done it that way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it worked then.
Yeah. And sometimes you can even download the professional versions of the different software because they give you a 30-day free trial. So Avast, AVG, Bitdefender. You may have to, if you can.
I'll find something, but let me say something about Consumers Report.
Yeah.
I always thought Norton was the best, but they got them rated 6. Now, I don't know whether they're very good or not, but Checkpoint is second, and it looks like it would be a pretty good one as far as the every year the renewal's $20 instead of higher, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I used to have PC Cillin, and now they got it rated number 1 on pretty near everything, which is kind of strange to me because I'm going to get different stuff, including spyware. Now, he don't have any spyware. And is there any programs I can download on that? Because I'm thinking it could be spyware, too. It changes.
Which version of Windows?
He's got XP, and I have, too.
Yeah, you can download MS Defender. It won't have, it'll ask to log on to get the latest update. Yeah. But, of course, you won't be able to do that. But you can still install it.
I don't have any trouble, you know. I keep everything updated on my spyware, but I will tell everybody that's listening, you need spyware, and you need to have virus protection, and you need them both updated all the time.
Yeah.
And be right on top of it, because I've lost 2 PCs, and one, it was supposed to be TDS notifying me of something, and I clicked on it, and bingo, I lost a real good computer.
Yeah.
And they redid it, and then it went bad again. So
yeah, it can be very frustrating and time-consuming.
Yeah,
and
I just bought a different one.
What's the saying? About being a dollar
Yeah, yeah.
Pennywise and Pound Foolish or something? Can,
yeah. Yeah, right.
There's a reason for that.
You ain't just
a kid
there. Yeah.
Thanks, Daryl.
Yeah, thank you.
Good
Pat,
luck.
Yeah, good luck. And Pat in Milwaukee, hi to you.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am entering this later, so you might have covered this. I went to Roadrunner for email, you know, and internet. And when I get in there, I can't. When I click on composing or replying or opening attachments, I get an X with a little yellow hand saying, you know, you can't do this. And I'm not sure. I have McAfee, and I was told maybe that the settings were too high. Is that possible?
That's possible. What are you trying to look at when you?
Just emails that people have sent me. It's a business account I've got here, and.
You can't actually see any of the email, or you can't see what's attached to the email, or
I can see the email, but okay. I can't see what's attached, and I can't reply.
Okay, depending upon what you're using for email, you could have the security settings too high.
Okay,
so that may be preventing what's attached from coming through. I know Outlook Express has that, and probably virtually every other email has that, where you can. They don't want you to inadvertently receive viruses, so they're limiting, what attachments come through. So that's a good thing and it's a bad thing,
right?
Because one is you can't see files if it's identifying it as potentially harmful.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is you can look for the settings and change those so the security is lower, but you want to make sure that you probably have an antivirus application on your system that's scanning. The email
right.
when it's coming in. So,
right.
And you said you have McAfee to do that.
Right.
Yeah. So I would check the settings in both your email and McAfee to see if, it's probably one of the two that's thwarting your ability to look at, everything that you get in your email.
Good luck.
You just have to pry around, look for options, preferences, anything that, that looks like it has settings, and sometimes you have to click one or two levels lower, dig deeper under the surface to find it.
We have an email from Georgia who says, my first computer was a PC, an IBM clone made in 86. I saved my files to a great big 5-inch floppy disk, or more than one, used a program called Perfect Writer, which was readable by WordPerfect. Then in 93, I got a Mac, a Performa, and saved to little disks. I'd installed a Word program in that Mac so I could share files with people who had PCs, but I never found anyone with two disk drives that could transfer material from my big floppies to the little ones. Now I have a Mac, iMac with OS 10.3.9. I save all my valued stuff from the Performa onto little disks, and I have a smart disk floppy drive. What am I reading from my old Performa? What I am reading from my old Performa, of course, was created in ClarisWorks. Is there any way I can recover files from my old 5-inch floppies?
Wow.
Yeah.
you can, but you have to find probably somebody with an IBM system. And you can still add the 5 1/4-inch floppy drives to it. I'm pretty sure even the latest firmware still has a support for it, but you're going to have to find a drive. The best luck you might have is either at a computer repair place that's been around for a long time, so they have access to that kind of parts, or on eBay where someone can actually sell you the drive. But you got to make sure you got the cables so you can hook it up. You really got to, do your homework and try and find a repair place that, has access to the parts and the warehouse, the knowledge that you need so they can copy those files over. Now, the key thing is the application and trying to read those files from the application. You may be able to get the files, but you're probably going to be running into problems opening up those files because you may not be able to read them. It may not be, unless you can find an application that's like the, generations
from 86
that can go back and read those files. And I'm not sure if Microsoft Word has the compatibility for reading those files. You may have to look for a utility that would, you know, potentially be able to open those files if you were able to, you know, get access to them again.
Here's another one from Shirley. She says, in doing research on adding RAM to my computer, I found a resource that said there's a maximum that could be added to a motherboard. Is this true?
Absolutely.
Yes.
In laptops, for example, they're shipped with two slots. So one with the one that they, you know, let's say a system comes with 256 and the next one you can fill up with another 256 or even a 1 gig and your max is at 1.2, but they may tell you that the maximum is 2 gigs support for it. Well, you have to take out that 256. It's, you know, not worth anything to you, maybe to somebody else, but, you know, you would put another 1 gig strip in there and now you're at your max of 2. So, you know, looking at specs on system boards and desktop computers, you can have anywhere from a 2 gig max to an Apple Mac Pro is 16.
Yeah.
You know, so you got a pretty good spread. And you might even be able to go beyond that, but it would probably be a special order and be more likely for someone that using a high-end gaming machine or a file server. But I would say the typical desktop max are anywhere from 2 to 4 gigs of RAM. But again, you got to check and make sure that you're not filling up all those slots with smaller denominations of memory, because basically you have to pull those out and substitute them with larger ones.
Yeah. Mike, you had a quick question from Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I've got a couple questions. I'll give you the easy one first, and that is I bought a computer last spring that has 2 gig of RAM in it. It's got a Intel processor in it. I think it's a Pentium 4, and it's got Windows Vista, and I just hate Vista. I've got a Windows ME machine right now that I'm still running that can run circles around this other machine, and it just doesn't seem logical. The other one's got a quarter as much RAM, and yet it outperforms the Vista machine. Can I possibly downgrade that new machine to like XP or even ME?
You can do it. The key thing is making sure you've got drivers to support, you know, going backwards, you know, to support support the hardware. So, you know, you could use something like Belark Advisor or, you know, like you said, you bought the machine, you should have all the supporting documentation. And just, you know, check and make sure you've got the device drivers, and you can download them from the manufacturer's website for all the different parts in your system. And when you go to redo the drive, you're probably going to have to use Vista to tell it that it no longer has a partition. And then once you reboot it, you basically are going to, you know, have to have another copy of Windows, whether it's ME or I would probably use XP, whether it's home or professional. And, you know, reconfigure the system using a new copy. Now, the thing with Windows is you have to have a full copy of XP, either version.
Mm.
You can't have an upgrade because it'll look
right.
at it. And if it's Vista, it'll say, well, this is newer than what you're trying to put on, so I'm not going to let you do that. So you need to have a full copy to install it, because it's going to look at it as if it's a brand new system.
And with that, we have to close. Pete, thank you so much.
Always great, Larry.
You'll be back next month. We'll
yep.
do this again. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, our personal computer consultant. Go to InfoStar.com to learn more about his operation. Thank you all for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.